X2Y versus Intel. Okay, please proceed.
May it please the court. I'd like to start today by addressing the prejudice factor and in a moment the death of Bill Anthony.
In the blue brief at 10, you say that following the denial of the petition for rehearing en banc in the ITC case in 2014, Alston and Byrd notified X2Y that it, quote, would no longer represent X2Y in the state district court cases. And in the blue brief at 44, you say X2Y was not represented by counsel from 2014 to 2017. And then in the gray brief at 6, you reiterate that X2Y was not represented for that period. The red brief at 31 says Alston and Byrd still represented X2Y during that time period. Is it your position, I want to be clear on this, your position that Alston Byrd and Byrd was not X2Y's counsel from 2014 right through to 2017?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there was no counsel during that time period?
That's correct.
Okay. You do understand that a corporation may not generally appear pro se?
That's correct.
And you're aware that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Harkness says that it is clear, the law is clear that a corporation may appear in court only through an attorney at law admitted before the court. So is it fair to say that during that time period where you say X2Y was not represented, that X2Y could not appear in court and could not maintain its state district court case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Doesn't that on its own warrant dismissal?
No, Your Honor.
There's nobody in the case. There is no party.
Oh, there's a party, Your Honor. There's a party. There is no representation.
There's no one appearing.
Your Honor, when you lose counsel in a case, you lose the ability to have somebody arguing in court as
you
a member
lose,
of the bar.
Wait. The rules of civil procedure are written. For example, there's a requirement in local rules that counsel maintain an office from X period to Y period during these days in order for service to be affected, personal service to be affected, and so on. For a party opposing someone, they have to be able to have someone with whom they can deal on a court basis. But for that 3-year period, the other side has no one. There is no entity that's in court.
Your Honor, the entity still remains the company. The company was still a party to that lawsuit. The lawsuit was both stayed and administratively closed. If the case were active and X2Y had lost their counsel, they would at that point have to notify the court that I cannot proceed at this point in this active case until I find new counsel. But the loss of counsel does not immediately and instantly dismiss the case against, require a dismissal of the case against the party, or the one brought by the party.
In the blue brief at 8, you explain that Alston and Byrd on its own decided to narrow the scope of the investigation on its own without consulting counsel. Is that correct? They didn't?
Without consulting the client.
Yeah, I'm sorry, without consulting the client.
That is correct, Your Honor, and it's the result of how the protective orders work in those cases. As you know, Your Honor, ITC matters operate extremely fast, very intensely, and for the most part, the clients are barred from seeing all the confidential information.
Some stuff, yeah.
So when they're sitting there, you have 20 attorneys who are looking over these discovery responses, product prior art that they're not even allowed to show their client. not to mention these confidential design files, the attorneys there made various decisions, and they determined on their own that they couldn't consult with the client. It all moved too fast. And in hindsight, when my clients got to get bits and pieces of information about what had happened, they realized that the attorneys had made various mistakes in narrowing certain of those claims.
You were aware of the improper corporation rule, of course, as a member of the Pennsylvania Bar, right?
I'm not a member of the Pennsylvania Bar.
Were you familiar with that law?
I was familiar with the law, Your Honor, that says a corporation that doesn't have in-house counsel cannot represent itself in a district court action.
So despite that, you took 3 years negotiating the contract?
Not exactly, Your Honor. We took 2 years and 9 months to sign up this case as a new client. The period of time that amounted to 2 years and 9 months is described in our declarations. It included due diligence on the merits, and also a very substantial portion of that included the client renegotiating contracts with their prior counsel and with the litigation funder, contracts that we, as the new counsel, insisted on be renegotiated before we could take on the case.
So you say that seriatim, you learned, October 1st, 2014, Alston tells X2Y it will not represent them in seeking certiorari. October 16th, they contact your firm, 2014. 9 months later, you notify X2Y that you're interested in representing. October of 2015, you agree in principle to a retention agreement. And then these issues come up. The agreement that existed with Alston and Byrd and so on. You are, and what I'm driving towards is you argue that X2Y is not responsible for that delay. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
If they had told you at the beginning that those various agreements existed, you could have resolved them at that point. Am I not correct?
Could have resolved them sooner. And I would say this, Your Honor. So
how are they not responsible for that?
Because we didn't ask them about those agreements, Your Honor. We didn't ask them about those agreements. Our firm is also a contingency firm. It would never occur to us that a prior firm was attempting to maintain a stake in a litigation where they had dropped the client. It also was, especially not then, and certainly not for our firm, as common to have litigation funding, much less litigation funding where the terms put at jeopardy new counsel's representation.
You said that in the blue brief, X2Y had no ability to move forward with the district court case in those 3 years before you signed. Couldn't they have sought other counsel?
They could, and they did, unsuccessfully, Your Honor. This is not an easy case to take over. There are very few firms that, after having seen the prior loss at the ITC affirmed by this court, would take on this matter against a very sophisticated set of corporate defendants on a contingency fee basis. Now, we all know there's plenty of firms that will take any case and file as many as they can, but that's not the kind of counsel that they needed for this case.
So the court made a passing reference to something judges sometimes say about not passing the smell test.
Yes.
And you say in the blue brief at 27, the court's subjective ability to smell out the right result does not appear inspire confidence and should not be evoked, especially when something as serious as a case-terminating sanction is being considered. What's your legal authority for that? Because I've seen reference to not passing the smell test any number of times.
Your Honor, it goes to assessing the credibility of the accusations. There was no basis for the court in reading our declarations, no basis to dispute the accuracy or truth of what we were saying. And when I read that statement in the order saying it doesn't pass the smell test from a district court who's never even seen the party stand in front of them, much less subject to cross-examination or questions at oral argument, what basis does the court reading those papers have to question the accuracy of those? And especially, Your Honor, when the other side didn't actually dispute the truth of our statements. They also didn't seek to take discovery or cross-examine us on this. And this comes very, back to the core abuse of discretion standard. One of the reasons.
3 years. What if I said to you, gee, I don't think it passed the smell test? Are you going to say that my ability to smell out the right result is questionable?
Your Honor, I would say that if you look at the factors that are required under POLIS, whether you pass the smell test or not, the factors require granting at least less severe sanctions.
Okay, let's turn to the factors in POLIS, because this is a process thing, but it's very significant to me. And that is, by the time we get to Gray, you level kind of an accusation against your opposing counsel. And it involves the use of ellipses, which I take very seriously. There have been at least two occasions since I've been on the bench where we sanctioned someone and did something else to people for misusing ellipses. And here there were ellipses used with respect to the second factor of Poulos. And you make a big deal of that in Gray. And in Gray you say, among other things, Intel fully states all the other factors, but for the prejudice factor, Intel uses an ellipses to omit the words yada-da. Intel did not do that to save space or to remove irrelevant or superfluous words from the test. The purpose, so we're talking about intent here, of Intel's edit was to delete a material part of the POLIS test that Intel cannot meet. Well, I took that accusation very seriously, and we went back through a lot of things, including Third Circuit opinions. Now, as you know, the district court also didn't use ellipses but omitted the phrase that you think is so important. There have been Third Circuit opinions since then, which I think Intel cites in red, that have really, you know, Poulos happened to do with a scheduling order or discovery. But nobody in the Third Circuit thinks that Poulos was necessarily limited to just those two process items. And indeed, there have been subsequent Third Circuit cases which have dealt with other matters more comparable to this. So I guess I really think it goes a little too far to really make what is really kind of almost an ethical charge against someone for doing something improper, where you can try to convince me otherwise, but I think the position they've taken and their use of ellipses in this case is entirely consistent with Third Circuit authority applying Poulos. That's my take. Tell me if you think I'm wrong or if you just want to take it back.
I don't want to take it back, but I will say it was not leveled as an ethical accusation, Your Honor. That is absolutely how we read the case, and there is no basis for us to understand that ellipses when they do not cite.
Well, are you familiar with the Third Circuit case in Hildebrand versus Allegheny County? Are you familiar with Adams versus Trustees of New Jersey? And I can go on, but the Third Circuit has clearly not limited Poulos to this failure to meet a scheduling order or discovery, has it?
In Adams, Your Honor, no, Your Honor. I would direct Your Honor to the result in that case. That, like every other case in which there was not a violation of a discovery obligation or not a violation of a court order, the dismissal was always reversed, or a decision not to dismiss was always affirmed.
Are you standing here today and saying that you think Third Circuit law and the Poulos test and that particular factor covers only prejudice with regard to the failure to meet scheduling order or discovery? Is that your reading?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that.
All right.
I'm saying that there is always only the case, all the cases that they cited where a dismissal under POLIS was affirmed involved a violation of a court order or a failure to comply with discovery obligations, and we do not have that here. And if I can return for a moment to the prejudice factor, they are required as the moving party to submit evidence to substantiate their claims of prejudice. With the exception of them pointing out that our inventor, Bill Anthony, died, everything else they submitted was mere speculation. Witnesses could be – yes, Your Honor, do you have a question?
No, I'm just dropping my jaw in awe at what you just said. It's mere speculation to say that after at least 3 years and more like a lot more than that, that witnesses' recollections will have dimmed. Is that mere speculation?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Yes, it is.
Are there a bunch of cases that say that?
Your Honor, their own brief says it. Their own brief below told the district court that we can only speculate at this time because it's early in the case, and we need to further figure out what their theories are before we can tell you, here, these witnesses have been lost. Now, if
lost
possible—
or unable to recollect. You can't tell me that a delay of that period does not impact a party's ability to litigate except for extraordinary circumstances where everything has already been fully preserved.
I can, Your Honor. This is the one case among any other where that passage of time did not prejudice them. And if I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, I'm well into my rebuttal, if that's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Michael Summerskill. May it please the Court, Michael Summerskill on behalf of Appellee Intel. This is a case in which we believe the district court properly exercised her broad discretion to dismiss, where X2I delayed for nearly 3 years. In that time, two critical X2I witnesses died, memories inevitably faded, and evidence, which was already 17 years old, became older and thus harder to locate. X2I admitted that it deliberately did not tell Intel or the court that it ultimately intended to try to reopen the case. X2I's delay followed what the ITC found was a 9-year strategic delay before bringing the case in the first place.
What about your friend's last point about how you conceded that all of this parade of horribles was speculative?
We certainly have not conceded that the prejudice is speculative. We've outlined in our brief a very specific prejudice, and I think I'll walk through that. The first is the death of two critical witnesses. One, the sole remaining inventor, Bill Anthony, who was also principal of the case, and two, Don Harris, who was the other co-founder of X2I. And so X2I is now a one-person company. There's one witness left. We've lost two of the critical witnesses. Now, this is also a patent case, as your honors know, and we've lost the sole remaining inventor. And an inventor plays an important role in a patent case, of course.
But the patent has expired now, right?
The patent has expired.
And Intel has had a period of time where I assume, assuming theoretically that there was infringement here, Intel has invested considerable funds, I assume, assuming that the patent was valid for the period it was in effect.
Well, we certainly didn't assume validity or infringement, but yes, Intel has invested substantial funds both before the delay and after the delay.
Okay. I have a question for you, and it's a difficult question because I'm going to refer you to page 3 of your red brief. And so I can't read it. That's why it's difficult. So much of it is highlighted as confidential. But you can read it to yourself, okay? So starting at in the penultimate paragraph, right around, okay, there's a reference to appendix at 759, okay? So you have that long sentence that begins, X2Y is no innocent victim. And then it runs through all this confidential stuff. And you reference me to appendix 759. And I want you to look at that and tell me what the generation of that document is. If you can, because I guess it has confidential information in it too. It says, contains business confidential information.
Yes, sir.
How did it come into existence?
This, Your Honor, was a document created by X2I, and I believe Bill Anthony was actually involved in the creation of this document.
Okay, and then you reference me. Us to the same thing in another place, but it's the same document, where you say X2Y presentation. Okay, that's why I asked that question. And then the appendix at 129 and 30. And I want you to look at that reference and then look at the blue brief. I told you this was convoluted at 40.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, which?
Look at the reference at 129 and 30. I'm sorry, audience, but we have to be careful on confidential stuff.
So, Your Honor, 129
and 30. That's testimony, okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then I want to take you to the blue brief at 40. And to me, I get as bothered as the chief does on allegations that a lawyer is a liar. And so I look carefully. And there's that last full paragraph that ends, "These assertions are irrelevant and false." Okay? And to me, these pages put the direct lie to that statement. And when I'm using that word, counsel, I mean the direct lie. So I want you to, as you can, and I'm sorry I made this so convoluted, but it's because you have to deal with the confidential stuff. I want you to discuss that.
Well, Your Honor, I agree with you that the statement about this X to Y document is not true. And I agree with Your Honor that the allegations against us are not true. And I think that particular document, I think to find the right place on that, you know, there was an extensive evidentiary hearing at the ITC, and the ITC made a specific finding on that. It's Appendix 286. Again, I can't read it, but the sum and substance is that X2I was no innocent party. X2I strategically delayed bringing the lawsuit in the first place for 9 years. And so here we have a delay for 3 years and the failure to prosecute this case, but that's compounded by a 9-year delay. And I think it also gives a little context in terms of the responsibility for the delay. You have the same type of thing happening where X2I admits that they deliberately did not come to Intel or to the court to say we're ultimately seeking to reopen this because they didn't want Intel to take any steps. In other words, they were aware that there could be some prejudice that was caused to us, and they didn't want us to address that. And we think that's very significant. And the prejudice...
I have to tell you, just, Jane Jones, you've been accused of multiple things, and I think it's very significant when somebody accuses an attorney or a firm of misconduct. And that I'm sorry for eating your time, but if you can't tell, I'm really frosted about it.
Well, Your Honor, we agree. We were troubled by it. As a litigator, sometimes we receive things like that, and we move forward and focus on the merits for the client. And you know, I want to emphasize here the prejudice piece because I think it is very important. X2I has argued that, well, we took Mr. Anthony's deposition in the ITC case, so why do we need it again? Well, we need it again because there are different issues that would come up in this subsequent case. Damages and the reasonable royalty analysis. That's something that would be at issue here, was not issue there. Bill Anthony was directly involved in licensing discussions. That testimony would be highly relevant to a Georgia-Pacific analysis. Validity. In the new cases, we'd be entitled to raise new invalidity arguments and new prior art. Now, we won't have the opportunity, we wouldn't have the opportunity to take Mr. Anthony's deposition on new prior art and get admissions. You know, validity, as Your Honor knows, is a fact issue. We wouldn't have the opportunity to get admissions based on what's in that prior art. That's both relevant to validity and very powerful trial testimony. And third, to the extent they tried to raise new infringement arguments or new infringement theory, we ought to have the ability to take the inventor's deposition on whether that theory is consistent with what he said he invented in the first place.
Well, let me ask you, that goes to the point, I think, that the other side, one of their criticisms of the district court is that they should have gotten an opportunity to have an alternative sanction, because this is at the most draconian end. So I think there is some noise made about how, well, they could limit it certain things to ease the concerns that you raise with respect to the passage of time. Did they present any specific alternatives to the district court and arguments why that would mitigate the prejudice to you?
They didn't present any of the alternative sanctions to the district court that they are arguing in their appellate brief. They did note that one possibility was dismissal without prejudice and argue that that shouldn't be implemented. So effectively, they didn't argue any alternative sanctions. We would submit that there are no alternative sanctions that could address the harm. And if you look at Third Circuit law and the Poulos case and the Windward case and then the Hyatt case, which is District of Columbia, all of those are consistent with what happened here, is where there is significant prejudice and that prejudice can't be undone, then an alternative sanction is not sufficient. Here, X2I's choices caused this 3-year delay. They deliberately chose not to tell Intel and the court what was going on. And again, that delay followed what the ITC found was a 9-year strategic delay. So now we're 20 years out from, you know, the priority date of the patent. So we're talking about 20-year-old evidence. And the result of that conduct is we've lost two critical witnesses, memories have inevitably faded, and evidence such as product prior art, you know, old Intel systems, old Apple systems, is just necessarily harder to locate, and it's harder to find witnesses who can speak to it. And those are precisely the circumstances where the Third Circuit has found alternative sanctions are not sufficient. So the Windward case, I think, sums it up. Fines and costs cannot turn back the clock or restore blurred memories or missing files. And I think that's exactly what we have here. Now, Your Honors, I think the third factor to address is, well, so we've talked about the fact that there was significant prejudice. It's significant prejudice that can't be undone. Well, what was the cause of it? Who was responsible? And we'd submit that X2I was squarely responsible. As the district court found, it was X2I who was specifically responsible for retaining new counsel. And it's just simply not reasonable to take 3 years to retain new counsel. This wasn't a situation where a plaintiff was just uninvolved and the lawyers caused the delay. X2I was the one directly responsible for the delay. And if they had thought that the DeVell firm was taking too long, they could have sought out other lawyers. Second, the courts have made clear, including the Link case, you know, they try to blame the litigation funder, they try to blame the lawyers, but in the Link case and in the Poulos case itself and the Windward case, courts have made clear you can't hide behind your lawyers. And third, they're the ones who entered all of these contracts with the litigation funder, with Alston and Byrd, which they now complain constrained their ability to act. And finally, they're not the innocent, helpless victim that they claim to be. They had a very sophisticated patent litigation firm. They had a sophisticated litigation funder, and they still have that litigation funder today. So I'd close, Your Honors, with this. X2I, a corporate litigant backed by one of the biggest patent litigation firms in the country and backed by a litigation funder, was directly in the mix and responsible for the delay. That delay resulted in significant prejudice. There are no alternative sanctions that can undo that prejudice, that can undo the loss of witnesses. And X2I has already had its day in court. The ITC and this court have already considered and rejected the substantive merits of X2I's claims. And under the abuse of discretion standard, which, as Your Honors know, entitled the district court's ruling to great deference, we submit that her ruling should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Well, before you sit down, counsel, I'm going to add something. I disagree with you. I'm an old man. I litigated for 19 years and then was a trial judge for 16 years. And I think the most valuable thing you have, that any lawyer has, is their honor. And the value of their word and their reputation in the legal community. And I know you say, well, we've got to move on. You know, we look at it and we've got to move on. But it is very clear to me from what I've seen in the record, you were wronged. And I want to say that so that if anybody ever asks you you can say that that was recognized.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The district court had an independent duty to consider lesser sanctions. The court didn't do that here.
Did you give it some alternatives? Did you say, well, you can do this with the evidence or exclude this evidence and then also proceed this way?
We argued, Your Honor, that the sanction of dismissal was too harsh. Yeah. We also argued that some record should first be developed to see if they actually have established prejudice, and then a sanction can be tailored to that. And we gave a specific example of what that might look like.
Where in the record exactly did you say that? Because your opposing counsel says you argued against dismissal with prejudice.
We did argue against dismissal with prejudice and without prejudice. And in our brief, in our reply brief in the district court, we also argued that if they were actually able to establish prejudice, such as a reliance by them on the non-infringement finding that led them to develop a new product that read right on our patents, then the sanction in that case that would be tailored to that would be to exclude us from arguing that that product infringes. And that is in our reply brief. They don't deny that. They recognize it in their red brief as well. Your Honor, even under Polis, if you look at the Polis decision and the very first...
Wait a minute. So can we just go back to the first fine point, which is you did not propose or identify any alternative sanctions to the district court, right?
No, that's correct. Okay, we pointed out a hypothetical sanction that could be granted if they showed prejudice, but primarily at the district court, we did what we are allowed to do. It's their burden to identify lesser sanctions and show why they're not effective. It is the district court's independent duty to consider lesser sanctions and determine why they're less effective. And the reason we know that is because Polis is something that applies even when there's a sua sponte dismissal. And if you look at the very first Polis case, the one we cite is the second one. It also describes the first Polis case where the district court dismissed with prejudice, sua sponte, and they sent it back. They said, you did not consider lesser sanctions. And it wasn't about whether the parties identified it or not. That was the duty of the district court. And here...
In a sua sponte dismissal.
In a sua sponte dismissal and in a dismissal that's brought on by one of the parties, Your Honor. They are the moving party. And the only concrete piece of prejudice that they identified is their inability to take yet another deposition, a fourth day of deposition, from Mr. Anthony because he's no longer alive. The question that then becomes, is the proper sanction for that to throw the entire case out, to completely obliterate and extinguish these patents? That is an extreme sanction that is not justified by that showing of prejudice. And again, Your Honor, you can drop your jaw again, but I submit that the Third Circuit law says it's not enough to sit back and presume prejudice as a result of the mere passage of time. That was rejected in Adams. That was also rejected when this court addressed Polis in the Drome versus Perry case 3 years ago and said the assertions of prejudice were unsubstantiated. And if I can
final point.
Your Honor, Appendix 276 is where they admitted below that their assertions of prejudice were speculative. And, Your Honor, Judge Wallach, Appendix 758 is the prior slide in that X2Y presentation, which explains that they weren't talking in 2002. They weren't talking in 2002 about suing them for patent infringement, much less on patents that hadn't yet issued. They were talking about having discovered that the same three Intel engineers that came and met with the company in 1999 had copied X2Y's technology, put it in their own patent filings, and the decision was whether to sue them over that under the NDA or not. And if you look at the ALJ's initial determination, it's inconsistent on this point. On the one hand, it points to this presentation and says maybe X2Y should have been more upfront with Intel in their discussions, but it also expressly, in denying their latches defense, says that X2Y did not discover infringement until 2009. Not 2002, 2009.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Both sides, and the case is admitted.